Blog Talk Radio.
If it's Sunday, it's Wrestling Night in America here on PWTorchLivecast.com. Hello, everybody. I'm Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Greg Parks, hosting on this Sunday, August 26, 2018. And we have a lot in the wrestling world to talk about. We're going to have longtime PWTorch.com contributor Benjamin Tucker with us to discuss his live experiences over SummerSlam weekend at NXT, SummerSlam, and Raw. We will also cover the happenings on those shows, as well as SmackDown Tuesday night, all of the fallout from SummerSlam on Sunday night. Plus, we will preview what's coming up this week on Raw. We'll talk about All In, and we'll talk about the upcoming big Impact Wrestling show on Thursday night. But first, I want to welcome in my guest tonight, longtime PWTorch.com contributor Benjamin Tucker. Ben, thanks for being with me tonight.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure every time. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. And, you know, whenever we do the post-pay-per-view live cast on Sunday night, and if you didn't hear our post-SummerSlam Wrestling Night in America last week, you can catch up on that on PWTorchLivecast.com. We never have room to talk about TakeOver that happened the previous night, because we're wall-to-wall coverage of that WWE pay-per-view that night. So a little more than a week removed from TakeOver Brooklyn 4, I think it's time we here on Wrestling Night in America assess that show. And Ben, I know you were there live. Just give me your thoughts on TakeOver Brooklyn and where that ranks for you in the pantheon of NXT TakeOver events.
Sure. You know, I've been in person to probably the majority of the non-Full Sail based TakeOver events. And Brooklyn 4, I would say, was probably the most consistent TakeOver. I don't think it was something like New Orleans, where you had multiple five-star level classics in one night. But I thought that every single match on the show, with the exception of maybe Velveteen and EC3, was a very consistent 3 3/4-star, 4 1/4-star, just several solid, really, really good matches.
Yeah, certainly this was a TakeOver that it didn't put any of the other TakeOvers to shame, I don't think, but it was also in key tradition of TakeOver shows. As far as the quality, it falls in line, I would say, somewhere in the middle. It didn't stand out, but I don't think it was lagging behind any of the TakeOvers either. The other thing I wanted to ask you about relating to the event as a whole is we see a lot of times in professional wrestling that the hot thing in wrestling isn't the hot thing for very long. There's always something else to come along to grab the attention of the fans, or something is just hot for so long that it becomes so mainstream with even casual fans enjoying it that a lot of the fans who liked it in the first place kind of back off. And quite frankly, in wrestling, it's hard for something to stay hot for a long time. It's the nature of the business, I think. NXT and specifically TakeOver events have had a rabid following since the beginning. It's treated as the alternative to WWE. They cater to somewhat of a different fan base than WWE's main programming. Being in that crowd at Brooklyn, Ben, did you find that there was the same thirst, that there was the same excitement surrounding NXT and specifically TakeOver? Or has it become something people look forward to, but you don't get the sense that it's necessarily a hot product? How did you take the temperature of the live crowd?
It's somewhere in between. If
Okay.
Because I remember I went to the first official NXT live event in San Jose, and I believe it was 2015. And it was technically the first ones were at the Arnold Classic, but I think it was sort of mixed in with a TV taping and other stuff. The first full-on exclusive live event was in San Jose WrestleMania weekend in 2015. And that show, Brooklyn that year, I think even going into Shinsuke's debut match, all of those events, the crowd was so rabid and so just thirsty for different, new, and unique wrestling. It was really a feeling that from probably, I'd say, Brooklyn 2 onwards, I haven't felt in an NXT live crowd. And that's not to knock product right now. I still think the product is very hot. But if you look at the first year and a half that NXT was really broken out into the mainstream due to the WWE network, that was just molten crowd desire, similar to how crowds are feeling about All In coming up within the next week. It was like that for the first year and a half, and from then it's cooled off. But I'd say since 2016, when it had that initial cool down, it still remained very, very consistently popular.
Okay. Yeah, that's kind of the sense that I get, that people still look forward to these takeover events, and even to a certain extent NXT TV if they know something big is going to happen. So I think that the excitement level for NXT is still much higher at this point in the – I can't say company or organization because it's more of an arm of WWE, but this far into their run as an entity, I think it's kept that excitement level from the fans longer than I would have expected, I think. And that's a testament to the wrestlers. That's a testament to the booking. That's a testament to, you know, there's a lot of factors that go into it, you know, keeping the takeovers at 2.5 hours, keeping the TV at 1 hour per week. I think it's just such a contrast to what WWE offers elsewhere in their portfolio their fans really eat it
up. Yeah. And at the same time, you have the fact that the roster is constantly changing. Look at the roster this year compared to the year before, compared to the year before. They're entirely different products. Not to mention you have the subtextual theming, really, of each year in NXT. You had the first year, 2014, which was focused on heavyweights. The next year after that, there was a real focus on the women's division with, like, Sasha and Bayley. You had the main eventing NXT Respect. The following year, you had a real focus on tag teams. And then, you know, the last 2 years, you've been having the big top talents come in. It's really been an iterative, constantly evolving product. So whenever anything feels like it's starting to get old, it's, oh, no, they're gone. Here's something new. Here's something fresh, which the main product can't really do in its current incarnation.
Yeah, NXT as an organization, I guess, for lack of a better term, has been able to morph into whatever talent they have on top at the time. You know, like you said, those different iterations of NXT and what's been on top. So it's kind of a fluid being, kind of amorphous, that takes the shape of whoever is being booked on top, which I think is a good thing that it can be that fluid, because we see that WWE, like you said, it, you know, it's very cut and dry. WWE is what it is, and you as a wrestler have to fit into what they do. You know, there's no fitting anything that WWE does around the wrestlers on their roster.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
Well, here's one question I have, because Triple H has talked for a long time about there being about NXT being a third brand, but ultimately I feel like a lot, or at least most people, would agree that it's still to a large extent just developmental for the main roster. Do you think that the way that NXT is currently structured is the right way for it to be structured in terms of it being developmental? Or do you think that the way they promote certain superstars and the way that they essentially tell their story before they get up to the main roster. Do you think that that's hindering the talent when you see from a different side of it, you see someone like Elias, who was very much just plugging away on the house show circuit, barely on TV, and then he comes to the main roster and he explodes?
Yeah, I think there's a couple issues at play there. First of all, it's is it a separate brand from WWE versus developmental? You know, when you got men and women in NXT that have a wide array of experience levels from almost zero to years on the indies or in Impact Wrestling or have wrestled, you know, nationally, I think there's some, you know, it's developmental in name only for some of those guys and girls. And, you know, I think the developmental aspect of it is more of the training center and the live events, especially the Florida Loop that they do. That's where those wrestlers who need that experience in front of live crowds, who need that experience, who need that ring time, that's where they're going to get it, is the performance center and in front of the Florida crowds. And then you've got the other part of it, which is TV and takeovers, which are, you know, not so much developmental, but it's almost guys biding their time until they get called up to the main roster. They're obviously TV ready because they've been put on TV on either TakeOver or NXT, and they're ready to take the next step. Now, the other part of the question is sort of, you know, is NXT doing justice to men and women when they do get called up? And we talked about already how NXT is so different from the main roster. Should it be more similar to the main roster if the end goal is really to get these men and women ready for what they will experience on the main roster? I don't know how you replicate that in NXT. And I think it's a developmental for the wrestlers just as much as it is for Triple H, you know, because this is, we don't really know for sure, but there's some inkling that the main roster, when he does take over creatively, is going to be more like NXT than WWE. We've heard rumblings of the guys and the women he's hiring in NXT to work behind the scenes, to work in production. They will be his team, quote unquote, when he does get that spot on the main roster, taking over for Vince McMahon in that big chair. So, you know, there's just so many things at play, but I think when we look at those who have not had success in WWE, vis-a-vis their success in NXT, I think one thing you can look at is, well, is NXT really getting them ready for what they will face on the main roster? And I think that's a valid question. But again, I don't know how you replicate that in NXT. It's not like you can say, hey, guys, your creative is awesome, but be worse, because that's what these men and women are going to face on the main roster. So, you know, some people like Elias, which was, are able to be even bigger deals than they were in NXT. But unfortunately, that is the exception. Any follow-up for that, or do you want to move on to TakeOver and what happened?
I mean, I think that's at least a good starting point, because really those are some unanswerable questions at the moment. It really is sort of an open question, I guess, because, you know, to be fair, if I had to choose, I'd rather have these people be completely unprepared for the main roster and continue to deliver shows like TakeOver last week. So,
yeah, there's a lot of balls in play for the NXT as a brand. And I know Triple H is very proud of it, and he should be. It's the part of the value of the WWE network too, is the fact that, you know, NXT TV is very popular. Takeovers are very popular. So that's an important part of the network as well. When we come back, we will start talking about the Takeover lineup and what happened and Ben's in-person point of view coming up after this break. Don't go anywhere. Wrestling Night in America returns right after this.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solid Monster sounds off.
Mundo goes to leave, and Taya says, "Wait, aren't you going to put any pants on?" He just goes, "No time for pants."
and he walks off. That also happens to be Randy Orton's philosophy in life. My philosophy, too. You see, you don't know if I'm wearing pants right now or not, do you? You can't see. I could be wearing nothing right now for all you know. No time for pants.
Since 2007, The Solomonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Back here on Wrestling Night in America on PWTorchLivecast.com, Greg Parks and Benjamin Tucker here with you, running down the NXT TakeOver experience from this past Saturday. If you've got thoughts on any of the big events in pro wrestling, give us a call. 515-605-9345 is the number to talk to us. And Ben, I want to start with the tag team title match that led off the show, Undisputed Era versus Mustache Mountain. We've seen a couple matches. We've seen a match on TV. We've seen a match in the UK. And now we've seen this one here at TakeOver in Brooklyn. Where would you rank this match that we saw Saturday night in those in with those other matches these two teams have had?
Oh, such a great question. It was definitely better than their NXT TV match. The crowd for their first match in the UK almost automatically puts that one up on top for me. But the live crowd at TakeOver Brooklyn was still super good, and the whole match was really strong. So it's at least a strong number two out of three in the series.
Would you call it one of the stronger opening matches on any TakeOver?
That's another great question. Yeah, it's definitely up there. For me, my favorite NXT opener is honestly probably Sami Zayn and Cesaro from the very first arrival. Although I'm sure that's probably rose-colored goggles because that was my very first exposure to NXT at all. But yeah, this was very, very good match.
Match number two, we saw Velveteen Dream over EC3. I thought this was the weakest match at TakeOver, which is not a surprise. I don't think anyone expected this to, this wasn't even really a under the radar match that people thought may surprise us. I think we got what we expected out of this one. EC3, to me, he's got so much muscle mass, it almost limits his mobility, I feel like, especially when you've got somebody in there who can really fly around like Velveteen Dream. What was the crowd's reaction to EC3? Because he's kind of got a bit of a heelish character, but Dream plays a heelish character. In a crowd like Brooklyn, they're going to cheer Velveteen Dream. So did you think EC3 got a decent reaction there?
You could tell that the crowd respected EC3, but I feel like if it was Velveteen Dream against Jesus Christ, Velveteen Dream would have still been cheered. So he did about as well as he could have, but it was really a no-win situation. Velveteen Dream, I'm still really digging, but I've been in person for I think every one of his TakeOver matches. And it seems to me, and I could be wrong because I'm not a wrestler and I have no wrestling training or anything like that, but when I watch him, it seems like he's always trying to do things that he's not necessarily fully comfortable doing, if that makes any sense. There was the Aleister Black match last year was fantastic. The Cassius Ohno match, I don't know if you remember, but the ending was a little rough. He seemed to sort of lose his footing after a little bit. The ladder match in New Orleans, there were several times where it seemed like he was almost going to slip off the top rope or not. And he seemed very, not as in he was telling a story, but where he's supposed to be this real big powerhouse. And he's like, oh, nope, my foot got caught in the ladder. And even in this last match, he seemed to be just a little bit out of his comfort zone, which I'm sure is good for learning and practicing and such, but it's enough of a consistent theme in his matches, just the small little bits here and there, that I'm not sure if someone should be telling him, okay, maybe try that on the live event circuit, but dial it back for the takeovers or stay with what you know, or what the deal with that is. I could be entirely wrong, too.
No, I think you're right. There is some awkwardness to his in-ring style that shows itself in these big matches that we've seen. I compare it to Miz on the main roster. They're two very different wrestlers, but you know, you get some of those moments in big Miz matches where it's almost he's going too fast, and you'll see some awkwardness with him. Dream is a better athlete than the Miz, but that sometimes can make up for it. But yeah, he's still got a ways to go. You know, people talk about him. You know, he wore the call me up Vince tights. People are kind of already fantasy booking what his main roster run, how to introduce him, that sort of thing. But you know, he's a guy who could probably use, I don't know, another year in NXT, maybe.
I agree with
that. Is that too long? Yeah.
No, I think that that's good. I feel like if you keep, I don't think you should call people up purely based on how popular they are in NXT. Because if you're worried about them cooling off in NXT, then imagine how quickly they're going to cool off on the main roster, right? Mm-hmm. NXT, it should be, you know, with how they've managed people, you should be able to keep them plenty hot in NXT. In worst case, if they're there for a while and people start to see them as more of a stalwart and they cool off a bit, who cares? That's,
all right.
You know, I don't know how many people watch NXT on a weekly basis, but that's at most, what, a third of the people who watch Raw? At absolute most, a third of the people who watch Raw. Who cares? If he's good, he'll rise to the occasion, you know? But, yeah, I definitely think he needs more time, especially at his age and the amount of wear and tear that being on the road can do to you. There is not a fantastic history of people his age starting out on the main roster.
Yeah. Match number three was Ricochet over Adam Cole for the North American title. I know that Adam Cole, even though he's a heel, tends to be pretty popular wherever he goes, and that excitement for him is at a different level usually for takeovers. So take me back to Brooklyn and Ricochet. You know, this wasn't like Adam Cole was going against a lukewarm babyface. I mean, Ricochet is pretty strong babyface and gets good reactions in his own right. How was the crowd split for this one? Was it a situation where some people cheered Cole and some people cheered Ricochet, or were they both very popular and people just wanted to see a really good match?
It felt very much like a PWG match. Everyone was sort of cheering for everyone. And when there were specific heel spots like Adam Cole rolling out of the ring, the crowd booed it. But it wasn't something like Dream EC3 where the crowd really just wanted to cheer Dream. It was a match where people were just excited that it was happening more than anything.
Cool. Yeah. I know I was excited that it was happening more than anything else, you know, just watching at home. We saw the debut of Matt Riddle, who was shown in the crowd, which was one of the worst kept secrets in pro wrestling, if you know where to look, that Matt Riddle was joining WWE. I think, Ben, you may have broken the news on Twitter that Riddle was in fact wearing flip flops with his suit. I think you posted that picture, and I'm not sure if anyone had that before you. So I'm going to give you credit here until I get yelled at on Twitter for someone else having that first. But what where does Matt Riddle fit into NXT? You know, he's a very unique personality. He's somebody that WWE has had their eye on for a long time. You know, where does he fit in? He's a guy who fits into NXT way better right now than he fits into WWE main roster. I don't think that's a stretch to say, but you know, what does he bring to the table for NXT?
What does anybody bring to the table for NXT at this point? It's one of the best rosters you could possibly have in the history of wrestling, right? I mean, where does he fit in? Where does Keith Lee fit in? If I had to guess, they would probably put Riddle in the North American title picture. I don't see them presenting him as an NXT champion level competitor, because I don't think they see him as a WWE championship level guy. And I think he's immensely talented. I just, based on his personality and everything, I just don't think they're going to see him at that level. So, and I don't think Triple H would, unless it was like a Hideo Itami one takeover worth, I don't think they'd bother to present him on that, to make him a viable long-term NXT title challenger. I think the next person to really be added to that mix would probably be Keith Lee.
Lee has already debuted on NXT TV. You know, looks like he's going to be a major player, which is not a surprise. You know, you have a Keith Lee, you're going to put him into an important situation right away, probably. The semi-main event at TakeOver was Kairi Sane winning the NXT Women's Championship over Shayna Baszler. Ben, one of the sort of complaints about the booking of Asuka in NXT as strongly as they booked her, and as many people supported that, but the problem was when she was positioned in major matches, title matches at TakeOvers, the fans did such a good job of building her up as unbeatable that the fans really didn't buy her opposition in any real way, especially when Asuka was selling. So they've built up Shayna Baszler in a similar way, not the same, but similar as far as just being this monster heel. Did you get a sense that the fans really bought Kairi Sane as a real credible challenger to Shayna Baszler?
They didn't at first. I feel like by the end they certainly did. That's sort of the boat I was in. I feel like they did a good job in the
I see what you did there. You said that was the boat you were in when we were talking about the pirate.
There you go.
Kairi Sane. That's clever.
There you go. Yeah, but I feel like they did a good job on NXT, at least playing up the fact where Kairi was effectively the underdog, but she had beaten her before, which means she can do it again. And I liked her confidence going into the show. But at the start, I really thought it was Shayna's match. Seeing Kairi come back, I really feel like it was the most underrated match potentially of the whole weekend. I really, really enjoyed the match. It was honestly one of my favorite matches of the night even. And that was on a very strong card. But I just thought the story they told was really good. I think Shayna is so incredible with delivering her offense. I mean, if I saw Shayna Baszler, like, in a dark alley, I wouldn't even run away. I just bash my head into the wall because it would probably be better than the punishment I'd be expecting from her. So I just really like the match, and I think both of them are super talented.
The main event, Tommaso Ciampa retaining his NXT title over Johnny Gargano. I want to ask kind of about the aftermath of it, so it's more of your personal opinion maybe than what the crowd felt, but how many times is Johnny going to fail at taking out Ciampa before the crowd decides to kind of poo-poo him? And I think we've seen, if you read the spoilers for NXT TV being taped, I think we're starting to see the effects of that. And as sort of a side question to that, is a heel Johnny Gargano the way to go maybe now? You know, maybe the frustration of not being able to beat Tommaso Ciampa has kind of taken him over. He, in the build-up to this match, took on a harder edge. Have we reached the end of the line for babyface Johnny Gargano?
No, I don't think so. I just feel like we're at the on the proverbial hero's journey. This is the bottoming out point, right? But Johnny is effectively going through a 3X arc, I suppose, where he was betrayed. He got a win, but then he was promptly screwed over the second time around. And not only then, he made everything worse. So he has his one final shot to get everything right, and then everything collapses. So, no, it's like, yeah, the fans right now are supposed to not believe in Johnny. And then now is the time for him to regroup, figure out what he did wrong, to rediscover the old Johnny wrestling and defeat Tommaso on his terms. I think it's a well done story. I thought what I will say is while the match was very good, I feel like the ending was, considering the punishment they put each other through, the ending fell very flat to me and a large portion of the crowd. Out of all the takeovers I've been to, it was the first takeover where the show ended and the crowd was like, that was kind of bullshit, you know? So they say, oh, thanks for coming, everyone. And they, you know, there's like light boos in the building, which once again, it's a heel winning. You're not happy about it, but it felt more like, well, that was stupid, right?
The heat was more on the booking than on Ciampa.
Yeah, and to clarify, it's not because Johnny lost, right? People are fine with Johnny losing, but from a storytelling perspective, if you have Tommaso hitting him with his finisher three times in a row and putting Johnny through a table, let's say, and you have him smashing Johnny through the barricade and putting 500 pounds of material rubble on top of him, and then Johnny lightly brushes against a box and he can't get up. It's like, what? That's kind of stupid, right?
Yeah, I thought that Johnny versus Ciampa was, it was a really good match, but I think I'm ready to move on from this. And I, that's why I was hoping Johnny would win the title and that it would lead to maybe a new direction and things like that, because, you know, they've done a fantastic job with this story and stretching it out for as long as they have. But it also feels like it's, you know, it's time to go home. To use some wrestling parlance on that. But I don't think we've seen the last of Johnny versus Tommaso. We are going to come back right after this and talk Ben's live SummerSlam thoughts and hear from you, the callers, 515-605-9345. So stay tuned here on Wrestling Night in America on PWTorchLiveCast.com.
Wrestling fans, if you're looking for a unique and entertaining way to get your wrestling podcast fix, check out Ring Rust Radio. Ring Rust Radio uses its trademark brand of banter to cover all professional wrestling you love, including WWE, NXT, New Japan, Lucha Underground, ROH, Impact Wrestling, and more. We also hold sit-down interviews with some of the biggest names in the history of the business, such as Stone Cold Steve Austin, Shawn Michaels, Bret Hart, Chris Jericho, Kurt Angle, Trish Stratus, AJ Styles, and Roman Reigns. For those of you who want their wrestling with a perfect mix of serious analysis and comic relief, find Ring Rust Radio dropping every Wednesday night on Blog Talk Radio, iTunes, Stitcher, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Wrestling Night in America continues here on PWTorchLiveCast.com. I'm Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Greg Parks. You can find me on Twitter at Greg M. Parks. And I'm joined by longtime PWTorch.com contributor Benjamin Tucker. He can be found at BTuckerTorch on Twitter. And we're going to go to the phones for our first call of the evening. It's the 814 area code. I believe this is Ryan from Cumberland, Maryland. Ryan, is that you?
That is me.
Welcome to the show, Ryan. What have you got for us tonight?
Okay, your guest tonight, I have a question for him. I saw an interesting video of a fan doing a weird dance. I guess it's related to Roman Reigns. My questions are concerning this is, did he actually get kicked out, and what did he actually get? Is there like a law against dancing at WWE events now?
Yeah. I actually took one of those videos that made it online. This was actually the Raw the night after SummerSlam, for context. In the Roman Reigns Finn Balor main event, if you're watching live, I'm sure some of you will notice that the crowd was seemingly distracted about halfway through it. And what happened was there were two drunk fans, a man and a woman in the crowd. And the man in particular was extremely, extremely intoxicated. He really did not like Roman Reigns. So it went from yelling at Roman Reigns to jumping out of his seat and flipping off Roman Reigns to jumping into other people's seats and yelling at Roman Reigns, yelling at the people around him. And then once he saw that a bunch of people were giving him attention, he started to do like random Fortnite dances while flipping off and cursing Roman Reigns. So security actually went up to him and asked him to settle down. And he responded by giving them suckets, which is actually on my Twitter page, I think, right now. And then they followed that up with about 12 security came around the section. He almost got into a fist fight with one of the other people in his section, like right by a group of about four or five children. And then security promptly threw him and his friend out. So that is the long and the short of what happened. Basically, someone got far, far too drunk, almost started a fight around a bunch of kids, pissed off security. They really didn't have much of a choice but to kick him out.
And my second question for you is, you hadn't heard any stories about the Elias concert from Saturday, like if it actually like sold out and what type of attendance it had and if the fans were really into it and that type of stuff. Can you give a report on that?
It wasn't selling well. I don't know the exact numbers, but I do know because there were a few people talking about it, about potentially going to it. And the general consensus is, why in the hell would I go to an Elias concert on Saturday when it's running directly opposite of Takeover? So I don't know what the purpose of scheduling that was, if it was Elias trying to schedule something himself or not, but they cannibalized their own market by having NXT run at the exact same time as it.
Ben, do you see this being something that, you know, WWE maybe dipping their toe into the water a little bit to see what kind of interest is out there for Elias, you know, concerts at local, you know, places that, you know, not arenas, but, you know, he did the Elias Unplugged, I think, WrestleMania weekend in New Orleans. If they're in a big enough city for a pay-per-view, you know, do you see WWE trying to market Elias in concert live, you know, that weekend, the same weekend of a pay-per-view?
To me, this seems like something that would be more of a self-starter idea by Elias. Just based on previous wrestler interviews on how they pitch things to management, it's such a unique idea for him to actually be playing music as opposed to pretty much every other music gimmick in wrestling. The fact that he can actually play, whether it's good or bad, it seems like something that he's sort of spearheading. So I'm sure if they could get it to work, they would, but you know, time will tell.
Okay. Ryan, back to you for your third question.
My third question is, weekend I saw rookie Morton take on the Shamrock shooter, Killian Murphy, and for the West Virginia title. And Killian Murphy got the victory after the guiding light, Doug Rafferty, gave him a pair of brass knuckles to knock, or maybe a chain, possibly, of some sort of foreign object. He knocked out Ricky Morton and got the pinfall. Does this actually like do something for someone's career, getting a victory over Ricky Morton in a title match in a main event at a show with maybe like 200 or 300 people are at?
Yeah, I think that certainly can do something when you have a name wrestler. You know, context is everything. Is this a group that brings in name wrestlers often? You know, is it something that's once every couple months they bring in a Ricky Morton or another legend and have somebody go over? I think that's that the context matters when you're talking about this, but just from a strictly yes or no standpoint, I think if you have somebody who works that territory or works that independent all the time, yeah, that helps in the eyes of the local fans. And it's something that he can brag about, especially if he's a heel. You know, I beat Ricky Morton for this title, blah, blah, blah. You know, so I think that can really, really help. Ryan, thanks for joining us tonight. Appreciate the call. As always, look forward to hearing from you again.
Yeah, thanks for taking the call.
Absolutely. 515-605-9345 is the number to call if you'd like to chat with Ben Tucker and I. And right now we will move on to SummerSlam. And I won't go through match by match since we did that last week, talked about a lot about SummerSlam. But, Ben, I want to ask you more, again, from a live event perspective. The first thing I want to ask you about is the reaction to Becky Lynch, which was, to my ears, one of the loudest reactions by the crowd at SummerSlam, period. And
it was one of the biggest reactions of the weekend.
Okay, yeah, I think that's fair, too. And we'll talk more about this when we get talking about SmackDown a little later in the show, but is it just the fan base that loves Becky Lynch so much, or did WWE screw up the storyline? She's clearly a heel based on her promo on SmackDown, and the fans keep cheering her. Who's to blame here?
People just really like Becky. Becky is someone who's generally people have compared her a lot to Sami Zayn, but I think it's more akin to a Daniel Bryan situation, which a lot of people have also compared her to. And there is a difference between the two. With Sami Zayn, he was booked to pretty much lose constantly. Like, he lost and he lost and he lost. And contradictory to what a lot of people say, if you lose enough, people do start to lose faith in you after a certain point, right? And that's sort of what was happening with Sami Zayn. If he got a string of wins together, then people would get behind him, but they never really did that. Becky has always been at least a little bit protected. She was always the person who almost got the briefcase. She was always the person who almost got the title shot. She's always like number two or number three. And that's the Daniel Bryan thing that people can identify with, where Daniel Bryan was almost the person who would win the title before Randy takes the Money in the Bank briefcase from him. He was almost the main eventer. He was almost. It's that almost. Not, well, you could be doing really well, but no, you're going to lose every match. It's different. So with Becky, she's in this almost phase, and this is the first real tangible opportunity she's had in forever. People don't care about the fact that, Charlotte won a match too. Charlotte's really talented. People don't care about that. That's what real life is like. You don't watch wrestling for real life. In real life, yeah, Charlotte's going to become champion. Because Charlotte's a better athlete. She has better connections. She seems like a lovely person in real life. Why wouldn't Charlotte get it instead of Becky? Well, this is wrestling. It's fake. People watching Becky because she's like them. She's a scrappy underdog. It's like, wow, we can get behind Becky because Becky always almost gets it, but not quite. This is the ultimate almost. So we're going to finally potentially get it. So, but then Charlotte wins again. And so the crowd's frustrated. So the crowd identifies with Becky. It's not like even when Nakamura turned heel earlier in the year, which was a very similar fallout, right? Or a very similar situation. Even when Nakamura turned heel, people cheered because it's a heel turn and they like to see different things. They generally like Nakamura, but it's still not something where they can identify with Nakamura that much because, no, he lost fair and square, and he's not really an underdog. He's just really good. So if you lose, you lose. It's not like Becky, where Becky's designed to be the underdog, where you try to pick her up after she gets picked down, where you don't empathize with Nakamura. You empathize with Becky. They're two different types of characters. So when Becky, you're empathizing with her, and she's frustrated and pissed off and angry, and there's at least a kernel of truth there. And you're pissed off and angry, and there's a bit of a kernel of truth there. So when she snaps and she beats the tar out of Charlotte, you expect us to boo? No, we think that's great because we want to be the person who at our job, when the Charlotte of the office gets a promotion, we want to be able to slap the crap out of them. Because we can't do that, but now Becky's doing it. We can empathize with her, so we're like, yes, go, Becky. Please, do that again. That's what makes Stone Cold so great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'll certainly give more of my thoughts when we get to SmackDown, but if you buy into the comparison of Becky Lynch to Sami Zayn, the silver lining here is that Zayn turned out to be a pretty entertaining heel. And people were against his heel turn because he was such a good babyface. And he ended up being higher on the card with more important things to do as a heel than he probably would have been as a babyface. So, you know, he ended up being pretty good at it. And based on part of the promo on SmackDown, Becky Lynch seems like she could be a pretty good heel too with that character. So there is some hope, but if the fans keep cheering her, I don't know how they're going to fix that. But more on that later. We are going to take another break here and come back with more SummerSlam talk, and then we'll get into Monday Night Raw, which Ben was also in attendance for. More after this here on Wrestling Night in America on PWTorchLivecast.com.
Support what we do here at the PW Torch Livecast when you shop Amazon. Simply go to pwtorch.com/Amazon. We've simplified the page. There's a big Amazon logo. You click on it. It takes you right to Amazon's homepage. But because of that small detour, we get credit for your visit, and we get a commission on anything you buy on that shopping trip. That's pwtorch.com/Amazon. Thank you very much for your support.
Greg Parks and Benjamin Tucker back with you here on PWTorchLivecast.com Wrestling Night in America for Sunday, August 26, 2018. And we are reminiscing about SummerSlam last week. Ben was there live getting his reaction to some notes on the show. The next question I wanted to ask you about SummerSlam was Miz versus Daniel Bryan. That was a match that has been 10 years in the making. WWE on the Go Home episode of SmackDown did a great job in three separate video packages summing up the story. The Miz has done a great job as a heel. Fans react to him. Daniel Bryan, you know, top babyface, obviously, nothing more needs to be said. Yet, the match at SummerSlam didn't seem to get, in my mind, the reaction that I was expecting. It seemed a little subdued, and I didn't know if that was just the way the match was set up, its placement on the card, fatigue setting in for the live crowd. Am I wrong that the fans didn't react as loudly as one would expect? And if I'm not wrong, what do you attribute that to?
No, it was definitely the lull for the crowd. It came at just the wrong time where I think it was about 2.5 hours into the show. So for what a regular old pay-per-view would be, it's towards the end, but everyone knows they still have like half a show to go. So everyone was getting a little fatigued. But at the same time, the match moved really slowly, I think, from my perspective. There were times where I felt like they were about to kick it into a higher gear and really go for it, like we've seen with the multiple Miz-Rollins matches. But every time it felt like they were starting to gain momentum, they'd stop, they'd lay on the ground, they'd collect themselves, and it felt like a bit of a reset. So it just felt like they were moving about 15% slower than they really should have for that spot in the card.
And without a doubt, this is not a one-off. You know, this, and I made the argument last week on Wrestling Night in America, they could conceivably stretch this thing out to WrestleMania next year. I mean, that's how much depth there is in these characters, how much history there is between these two, that they could do that with very little problem. Will they? I tend to doubt it, because WWE has not lately been in the business of telling stories over that long a period of time. But that was kind of my takeaway from this match, is sort of similar to AJ Styles, Samoa Joe, which I think was the better match, but they were both similar in that I don't think this was a one-off for either one of them. And there may have been something where they were saving up for a match later on. Of course, then again, we thought that about Styles Nakamura, and I don't think they ever got to that point in three matches where they brought the house down the way everybody expected.
Yeah,
you mentioned
I mean,
go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, no, I was just agreeing with you.
Yes, I agree.
Well, I mean, feel free to agree with me as much as possible. I'll let you go if you want to agree with me. You know, you talked about fatigue setting in a little bit during Brian Miz. Is that the point in the show where you could tell that fans were kind of on the downswing, or, you know, did they get back up after that and crash hard a little later? I mean, when did you get a sense of the crowd really, you know, sort of metaphorically checking their watches, or literally?
That was honestly probably the lowest point in the show, because right after that, I think that was the last real long match of the show, if I remember correctly. And I have to say, I've been at all the like 18-hour long WrestleManias, the Survivor Series that feel like they're lasting forever. Out of all of the 4+ hour long shows, this one felt like a breeze compared to all of them, being there live in attendance. And I feel like if you're listening to the crowd, you'd sort of you'd probably agree with it, because, well, I don't know how it came across live, but I think it came across better, because right after that match, the crowd was pretty dead. They're like, okay, Miz is coming out. Like, what's next? Then you have, I think, the Corbin-Balor match, which was perfect placement, because all you needed was Balor to come out as the Demon, kick the crap out of Corbin, and you're done. Great. And what do you have for the rest of the night? You had, I think it was, you had the Rousey match, which was like 3 minutes. The main event was 7 minutes. You had Nakamura, Jeff Hardy, which was like 5 minutes. And every one of them was just boom, boom, boom. Just get them in, get them out, get them in, get them out. And for storyline purposes, it sort of worked for all of them.
Yeah, I agree.
I thought it was just really well done, smart thinking. And here's actually a question I've been thinking about. I want to ask this to you. Do you think that match lengths are too consistently long at this point, or too consistent? And here's my thing, is if you watch a match right now, they're either going to be shockingly fast or they're going to be over 20 minutes. The vast majority, unless it's a mid-card match, and it'll be between 8 and 15 minutes, right? Do you think that WWE could have, or wrestling in general, could have more interesting cards if matches weren't guaranteed to go? And if you think about it, Lesnar-Goldberg at WrestleMania was a fantastic match. It went about 5 minutes. Or you have, there's been tons of matches recently which have been really short and really good.
Yeah.
Do matches, and you can still tend to have longer matches, but is there something bad about a match between, let's say, what would be something where someone wouldn't like to have a short match? Let's imagine Seth Rollins and Daniel Bryan fight on pay-per-view. And they go only 10 minutes, but it's just 10 extremely, like, fast-paced, on-point, boom, 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 just throwing bombs left and right, and then the match ends in 10 minutes. Do you think that's something that in the future could be viable, where, you know, certain matches could go a shockingly long time and some go shockingly short and just run the gamut?
I think it's become viable now. I think WWE over the last 2 months, maybe longer, but I've noticed it specifically over the last 2 months with these longer pay-per-views and then putting on, you know, 10 to 12 match cards. They've been a lot more willing to go shorter with some of these matches than they have in the past. And it's amazing that we're even having this conversation, because the pendulum has swung now so far this way. When the Attitude Era, you know, 3-minute matches were long on TV. Pay-per-view was a different animal, but we just didn't get lengthy matches. And that was one of the main complaints about the Attitude Era, is the match lengths were not realistic. So when you had every match going 3 minutes, 1 minute, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, it didn't make sense. Now the pendulum has swung the other way, where we're sitting here saying, does every match need to be 15 minutes? And I think you're right. On TV the last few weeks, I think it was Raw, I've made a note, and I even wrote on Twitter this past week, like, just because, and I know Raw is 3 hours and you stretch the matches out to fill more time, but just because you have the time to go 15 minutes doesn't mean a match should go 15 minutes. And it was probably a Baron Corbin match I was talking about, because, you know, he's not, that's not his style right now. And maybe he'll grow into that. But when you ask him to go and fill 15 to 20 minutes of TV, it's difficult for him to do that. Or at least it's difficult for me, the viewer, to be invested in that length of a match. But I think when there's a combination of a storyline reason, for instance, this past Sunday, Finn Balor coming out as the Demon, yes, make short work of Baron Corbin as the Demon, and then there's a reason for that match to go short. So, yeah, I think WWE utilizing those short matches, and I agree with what you said about every match that went short at SummerSlam made sense to go short. There was no, you know, meat still left on the bone where you're thinking, you know, what, there's still all this time left. There's still all, you know, this, there's more of a reason to go long. I didn't see that for these, and I'm glad that WWE is willing to go short. There's also the issue of, and I don't know if this is a WWE, if this is a belief within the company, or if it's just the belief by some fans, is if you book a match to go 4 minutes on TV or on pay-per-view, it's damaging the guy who loses because he loses so quickly. I don't know that that's true necessarily, but I don't know if WWE and those within WWE believe that, but I know there is that sentiment out there amongst. So that's something that they would have to be pushing back against. But again, with what we saw at SummerSlam, with what we saw at the previous pay-per-view and the matches, more matches going shorter on pay-per-view than we're used to seeing, I think that's a good thing, and I think it helps, as you pointed out here, Ben, I think it helps the crowd stay in it longer because there's more moving parts, there's more action. When you're asking fans to sit for a longer time, which WWE is doing by stretching out the length of pay-per-view, you've got to give them a reason or give them a way to stay invested in the show. And you know, constantly putting out 15, 20-minute matches is nice, but by the fourth hour of that, you know, you're going to have fans falling asleep no matter what the quality is. So by switching things up, by keeping them on their toes in watching these matches and having them know that a match can end almost at any moment is going to keep them more interested in the show. So for all of those reasons, I think it's something WWE should be doing as far as the shorter matches. I think it's something they have shown that they are doing over the past couple months, and I just hope it continues.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think to answer the one question you were posing, I really don't think that in this day and age when MMA is so popular and there's such a crossover between MMA fans and wrestling fans, I don't think losing in a short way is necessarily bad. I don't think Goldberg losing at WrestleMania in 5 minutes made him look bad. I think Kevin Owens being dominated by Braun Strowman made him look bad. But if it was a 3-minute match where Owens hits him with like 15 moonsaults, and that's an exaggeration, but, you know, if it's an even match where Owens is beating him, but then he gets caught with the power slam, that would work because that happens in real life. That happens in MMA or whatever. And I honestly think that it would make the longer matches even better. And then it would make, because I think if every single person on a show has a 15-minute match, you don't gain anything. You're not like, well, I mean, yeah, I may have lost to Mojo Rawley, but I hung in with him for 15 minutes. It's no, that means nothing. It's because everyone lasted 15 minutes. I wrestled Hornswoggle for 15 minutes, you know? But if you have 2 weeks in a row where every match is 8 minutes, and then the week after that, you have Mojo Rawley wrestle a 15-minute match with Seth Rollins, then it's like, wow, he lasted 15 minutes, double the time anyone else has with Seth Rollins. That's really good, and then you can talk about it. Otherwise, it just rings hollow.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think it's something WWE should be in the business of doing more of, and I hope based on the most recent results that it's going to continue that way. When we get back, I will ask Ben about the main event of SummerSlam, then we'll talk about Raw coming up right after this. Don't you go anywhere on Wrestling Night in America on PWTorchLivecast.com.
We know you're a pro wrestling fan, but you might like MMA too. And if so, check out our sister site, MMATorch.com, with live fight event coverage, including UFC pay-per-views, previews of all UFC and Bellator events, the daily news digest, exclusive columns, flashbacks, and much more. Check it out. If you're a fan of MMA, you'll be a fan of MMATorch.com.
Greg Parks and Ben Tucker back with you here on the PW Torch Livecast Wrestling Night in America here for Sunday, August 26, 2018. We've got another pay-per-view coming up very soon, Hell in a Cell on September 16th. And, of course, on that evening here on Wrestling Night in America, we will go on the air live taking your phone calls and your thoughts on the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view as soon as it goes off the air. Every other week, we are here at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Main event of SummerSlam, and this was brilliantly booked by WWE from the point of view that bringing Braun Strowman out there would counteract the negative response that this match was bound to get with the dislike of Roman Reigns combined with the way WWE had been booking Brock Lesnar. It worked because, yes, fans still booed Roman, but really the only way they turned on the match was there was a "you both suck" chant, but that was really the only thing that I heard from the crowd that was a rejection of this match. And they kept Strowman involved in the match. They kept the match short. I just thought this from WWE's point of view was brilliantly booked.
It was probably the smartest match they've ever booked. You know, it's a commentary. They had to work this hard to make it work this way, but no, it was amazing because the crowd was ready. I mean, you could feel it in the crowd. Everyone was ready to break out the beach balls, to do the chanting and everything. Everyone was ready. Braun's music hits. The crowd is ecstatic. They're waiting for Braun. He gets taken out in the match. Roman wins, and everyone's like, all right, here comes Braun. And then Roman leaves. And I noticed on the screen that that the trademark logo came up on the scoreboard above the arena. And I'm like, wait, what's happening with Braun? And everyone around me is like, no, he's getting up right now. And I'm like, no, you guys don't understand. They just went off the air. No one had any idea. And all of a sudden Roman's walking up the ramp and people didn't really understand he wasn't cashing in until until I think JoJo said, all right, everyone, thanks for your money. Go home. So it was.
Yeah, I thought that even watching at home, I thought that explanation could have been handled better because they did go to a wide shot, and Strowman was still down at ringside, but there was no. The announcers didn't mention, well, you know, Braun obviously isn't cashing in his briefcase. You know, there was no mention of that, so we went off the air not knowing that he was not going to cash it in until they went off the air too. So we were kind of in the same boat as you guys. We didn't get a heads up on that.
Yeah, it was pretty fantastic. In all honesty.
Moving now to Raw. And this coming week, Raw is at the Scotiabank Arena in Toronto. WWE.com is advertising Braun Strowman confronting Roman Reigns one-on-one. And also speculating about when the Revival might be getting a tag title shot at the B-Team. But this past week on Raw, the Shield reunion was the big story coming out of this. And in attacking Braun Strowman, it seemed kind of – there's just so many balls in play right now. It's really going to be interesting Monday night to hear from them or maybe at least hear from Roman Reigns – to get a handle on the motivation, because you've got one of the hottest baby faces in Seth Rollins. You've got a strong baby face in Dean Ambrose, who's come back, but you know has the dour look on his face. So you could conceivably buy that he would be a heel. You've got Roman Reigns, who WWE has been pushing as a baby face, and the crowd has been rejecting and has been pushing for him to be a heel. And then you've got Braun Strowman, the baby face. So was this... did this feel, when you were live in the arena for this, did this feel like the Shield getting together long-term as a heel group, long-term as a babyface group, just getting revenge on Braun Strowman for what they felt. And, you know, remember the original intention of the Shield was, you know, to take out anyone who was, I don't know the quite way to describe it, but Braun Strowman, I think, and what he did to Reigns would have fit in that category. Or is this a short-term run? I mean, so I guess my questions are, heel or babyface, short-term or long-term?
I think if it was anyone other than Roman who did what the Shield did, I feel like it would have been a heel turn. With Roman, it's sort of always wacky booking, so I'm guessing he's a face and Braun's going to play the heel now. Which,
good luck.
I mean, Money in the Bank is always strange because it's inherently a heel maneuver to cash in, like Braun was cashing in. So if it was real life, yeah, the Shield are obviously the good guys because Money in the Bank is the most heel thing to do. In practice, though, it's everyone does that. You should just sort of take your lumps and accept it. You know, don't be such a dweeb Roman. But, you know, that's neither here nor there. I think that honestly speaks to a larger issue with WWE's booking, where you have the old school mindset of there needs to be a face and a heel, and you have WWE's mindset that they say is their mindset of, well, the fans can choose. And I don't want to make it a New Japan versus WWE discussion because that gets rammed down everyone's throats too much. But what I will say is that New Japan's essentially doing what I think WWE pays lip service to. When WWE says the fans can cheer who they want or not, there's no real faces or heels. I feel like that's sort of just a way to get negative fan reactions off their back. I think if they were really going for that, it would be like New Japan, where everyone is sort of a shades of gray, and there are more heel characters like, you know, Tama Tonga and the Firing Squad are straight up heel. They are just jerks. Then you have a little more like Minoru Suzuki, where most of the time he's a dastardly heel, but if he's against the Firing Squad, well, he has more respect and honor than them, so the crowd will cheer them. Or Okada is, or I guess Kenny Omega would be a better example. He's pretty much a pure face, but if there's somebody he has a grudge against, or if he's facing the hometown hero, he'll play dirty to win, and the crowd's going to more shades of gray. So then when you have something like this, which is very much in the same vein as that shades of gray, because you still have the commentary team fellatiating Roman, and you still have them obviously trying to pine for certain superstars to get certain reactions, then there's the disconnect, because it's like they do it when it serves them, but they don't do it when it doesn't. That's what creates that confusion. To answer your question, because I've gone so completely far off base from what you originally asked, if I had to fantasy book here, which is what everyone loves on podcasts, I'd imagine that they're going to have Braun and the Shield probably leading up to the Money in the Bank case being used sometime within the next 2 months. And with the Shield being intact as a face tandem, and I think it would probably end with Ambrose turning heel on presumably Seth, and Roman either losing the title or just sort of falling out of the picture because of that. Because I don't see them just randomly splitting apart. I don't see all three of them staying together into WrestleMania season. That's too clean and wholesome for WWE. That's not going to last too long.
One of the other big pieces of news coming out of Monday Night Raw was Stephanie McMahon giving Kurt Angle some time off. And they didn't say how long, but Baron Corbin, the constable of Raw, and that doesn't sound any less stupid the more I say that, but the constable, Baron Corbin, is now taking over as the lead decision maker on Raw while Angle is out. Where do you see this going? Will Kurt return as general manager at some point? Is this leading to an Angle versus Baron Corbin match down the line?
Oh, my God. That sounds terrible. It's, I mean, I feel bad for Kurt. I really do. You know, he's, I've heard rumors he's training for an in-ring comeback. I wouldn't be surprised if it led to a Team Angle versus Team Corbin at Survivor Series. But at this point, who really cares? Because unlike SmackDown, where Daniel Bryan clearly had his own voice, Paige clearly has her own voice, Kurt Angle and Mick Foley, all these GM runs have done is just sort of degrade the aura that they've had. And I could be just speaking for myself. Do you really get as excited about Mick Foley being on Raw nowadays as before he was announced GM? When he was announced as GM, wasn't that really cool? Oh, my God, remember Commissioner Foley from 2000? That's great. And now you think of him, and all you're going to remember is the year that he spent being Stephanie McMahon's punching bag. It's like, yeah. What? It's like, no, I don't want to. And now with Kurt, it's the same thing. You have, if he had standout match performances to rely on, that'd be one thing, but he doesn't. He comes out moving sort of like Mick Foley, sad as it is to say. And he spent the past year, year and a half, being Stephanie McMahon's punching bag and sharing his words. Hey, everyone, welcome to WWE Monday Night Raw. And it's really depressing. I was so excited to see Kurt back. I remember funny small hat Kurt and playing a guitar Kurt and singing Kurt and backstage GM Kurt and, I don't know, being thrown off a second-story building Kurt. But it's just something. Even the first night he was back, if you remember, Enzo and Cass had that great backstage segment with him. It was really short, but it was nice and cute and fun. And they've just sapped all the life out of him. I mean, there's only so many times you can have a once-in-a-generation superstar make a years-long awaited return and then just be like a vampire and suck all the life and energy out of him until he becomes a husk. They haven't protected him at all from looking, you know, relatively incompetent. It's an insult, really, for a guy who's given his entire body, his entire life to wrestling, and for them to trot him out there like, you know, the dying elephant that they just keep in the cage and prod with needles. It's depressing and it's frustrating. And at this point, it's who cares? Because they're either going to keep Kurt and he'll still be sad, or they'll find someone else and he'll be just as sad. They use the exact same script.
Yeah, when he was first introduced, they sort of made him a stronger character at first. But you're right, as time has gone on and as Steph McMahon has continued to lord over Monday Night Raw, as she is wont to do, Kurt has appeared a lot more, a lot less competent, I think is the word that I want to use. And then putting Baron Corbin there to question every decision he makes is made things a lot worse. Stephanie McMahon was on Raw to introduce Ronda Rousey, who won the Raw Women's Championship at SummerSlam. And Rousey gave a very rah-rah speech while the roster was at ringside, and he ended up putting Stephanie McMahon again in the armbar. And, you know, there's some speculation that this might lead to something between these two at Evolution in October. I really rather not see that, but we'll see. We didn't talk about Ronda Rousey when we talked about SummerSlam. In fact, I didn't realize it until after the fact, and then I tweeted about it. We were on the air for more than 90 minutes on SummerSlam evening, and not one caller. We had 11 callers call in. Not one caller talked about the Ronda Rousey win at SummerSlam, and I was shocked by that. I was surprised by that. So the reaction that Ronda got this weekend, it has her star cooled any since her debut, or do you think WWE is handling her booking well enough that the fans are still very solidly behind her as a babyface?
I think they're handling it about as well as they can, realistically. It's really funny with Ronda, where whenever she was in an ad over the weekend, you know, because they darken the crowd between Mad TV and they show ads for stuff, or like NXT when the show's starting. Whenever they showed Ronda during an ad, the crowd booed. It's like they really didn't want to cheer her. But then when Ronda comes out, every time she gets cheered. And then in her matches, she gets cheered because she's legitimately really, really improving and really doing well. And everything they ask of her, she does it. So I get the sense that the crowd wants to find a reason to not like her, but she's just so good given her experience level that people are finding it just impossible to.
We're going to take our last break. When we come back, I'll ask Ben about Triple H's promo from Raw, and then we'll move on to SmackDown. We'll talk All In and Impact right after this here on Wrestling Night in America on PWTorchLivecast.com.
You love pro wrestling podcasts, but you might not have time to listen to all of them. We'll help you decide which ones to listen to and keep you up to date on the ones you're missing at PWPodcasts.com. That website features written recaps of all of the top pro wrestling related podcasts, including Steve Austin, Bruce Prichard, Edge and Christian, and so on. Check it out. It's PWPodcasts.com, your home for written recaps of all pro wrestling personality hosted podcasts.
Back here on Wrestling Night in America, PWTorchLivecast.com. Greg Parks, Benjamin Tucker here. And Ben, I want to ask you finally for Raw about Triple H's promo. Did you get those goosebumps like you were watching vintage Triple H? Was there a buzz in the crowd that, ooh, this is the Triple H that I grew up watching and who cut 15-minute promos every week on Monday Night Raw? Was there a sense that you guys were watching something special when he was pushing his Undertaker match for Australia?
I mean, it sort of felt like 2002 Triple H in that it felt sort of forced down our throats. Beyond that, nothing much. No, it was a weird promo. And I get what he was going for, where he was like, you know, this is going to be the end of an era again, pretty much. That's the thesis, you know, the log line of the promo is that. But in practice, all he was doing is saying, yeah, all the matches I've had since then, I've been kind of trash. Which, what does that do? You know, that really cuts down on Seth's win against Triple H at WrestleMania. Daniel Bryan's win against Triple H
Those guys aren't legends. Those guys aren't legends like The Undertaker. They don't matter as much. That's the lesson I got.
Triple H, he's saying he's effectively a shell of what he used to be. When 2 years ago he won the world title, defended it against at least one or two people on the roster, and main evented WrestleMania with it. Like, yeah, we have short attention spans, but it's not that short. When you're in a featured act every single time, acting like The Undertaker hasn't shown up in years when he wrestled 3 months ago, it's utterly bizarre. I just didn't. It's like I get it, but so tone deaf with everything. And I mean, the crowd cheered it because, yeah, who doesn't want to see Triple H fight The Undertaker? But they could have gone about it in a much, and I can't think off the top of my head, but, you know, if you spend 3 minutes thinking about it, you could do something better than, yeah, we've really been shit for the past 3 years, but it's okay because we're, you know, better than everyone else. Am I right? So, hey, let's be good again for one more night and show all these mediocre players how it's actually done, you know? It was so bizarre. And to be fair, they've been much better the past few years on making the current talent look not as terrible compared to past legends. If you look at like 2012, that was probably the worst era when you had main eventers being punked out by 60-year-old guys every single week. Now you still sort of have that, but they at least relegate it to like, you know, Heath Slater, The Revival, get beaten up by, you know, somebody. But you don't have something like that very much anymore where it comes out and he's like, oh, you know, all you guys,
Ah, Pasha, you should have seen me back in the day. I was really good then. It was just so strange.
Sounded like a Paul McCartney impression.
Well, I may need a little bit of work.
No, that wasn't
bad.
How
you doing, Ringo?
I heard some Triple H in there, but McCartney was the first one that came to my mind. You mentioned the promo is being tone deaf, and that brings me to Becky Lynch on SmackDown. We just got out of the Roman Reigns era of will he or won't he win the title. He's finally won the title. We can kind of breathe a little bit because everybody who's booing him and trying to show WWE that they don't accept him as the top guy, they've lost. They've taken an L on that. They can continue booing him. They can kind of give up. They can whatever. But at least WWE has now gotten to that point where he's the top dog. Okay, we've made that decision. Now we get the Becky Lynch era of trying to work against fans. Got at SummerSlam, apparently didn't sway WWE from trying to book her as a heel with her explanation on SmackDown. I think it's a mistake to book her as a heel, but that's my opinion. If you want to book her as a heel and have the crowds cheer her anyway, that's WWE's prerogative. They've done that with wrestlers before. You can make the case, although I don't agree with it, you can make the case that Becky Lynch is a heel coming out of this story with Charlotte and Carmella. I think you made a great case for why she would be a babyface earlier in the show. You could make a case that, you know, she lost. You know, Charlotte wasn't trying to horn in on her title shot. Paige granted Charlotte a title shot. She earned her way into the match. She earned the win. And Becky attacked her after the match. So you can make the story that Becky's a heel. Fine. That's what WWE wants to do. If they want to continue pushing back against the fans, that's on them. But to script the promo the way they did on SmackDown, where she questions the allegiance of her fans, was as tone-deaf and as mind-boggling as I've seen a promo scripted in a long time. Not every heel has to glee against the crowd to turn heel. You don't have to include that in the heel promo. If she had just said the rest of the promo the way she did, I would still complain that she's a heel. Again, I could see the reason for it, and, you know, that's that. But to script her the way she did, when the fans were chanting her name and cheering so loudly for her and doing the same thing the previous night on SummerSlam, she's one of the women who has the strongest backing of any woman on either SmackDown or Raw roster. I don't know. I have no words for how imbecilic that made WWE come across by having her do that.
Yeah, and here's my question. Why does she need to be a straight up heel? Following up on one of my points from earlier, why, if we're in the era where WWE tells fans they have a voice, which they forced on themselves, we didn't need to have a voice, but WWE spent years calling us a universe, saying our voice is important. So they made that call. If we're going to be in this era where our voice is important and we cheer who we want, we boo who we want, then why do you need to have the commentary team shove down our throats? Oh my God, what a disgusting thing Becky did. Why do you need to have Becky turning on the fans? Just don't do that. Just let the fans decide and don't even talk about it. You can have Tom call the action, have Corey lean towards the people who are more aggressive and have Byron go towards the people who are more cookie cutter. But don't have the commentary team really frustrates me because you have them taking sides. If this is really a company where faces and heel alignments, which I like, but obviously fan bases have moved away from, so you really got to go with the crowd on that one. So if you're doing that, then don't have the commentary team take sides. Because then the booking is tone deaf. Just don't worry about it. Let the fans decide. Let them cheer who they want. Let them boo who they want. Do it like in New Japan, where Kevin Kelly is guys who he likes more than others, but ultimately he can go, hey, you know, Minoru Suzuki is kind of a maniac, but he gets the job done, and the crowd really respects him here tonight in Sapporo or wherever they are. Or so many different places they can handle that. The real issue isn't whether Becky's a heel or not. She can be aggressive. That would be great, an aggressive Becky. The fans can get behind that. She can be a rebel. She can start to cut corners. She can be like, okay, I'm going to grab the bull by the horns. This is, you know, I'm grabbing the brass ring. That's great. But if that's the case, then don't have the commentary team shove down your throats. God, what a despicable person Becky's become. Don't have her go, oh, you fans never respected me, did you? Just don't bother.
And I think that the announcers lose credibility too when they are talking about how despicable Becky's been, when the fans at home are going, wait a minute, she had good cause for doing that. You know, her supposed best friend Charlotte took away what should have been her moment. So, you know, the announcers lose credibility that way. You know, the conspiracy theorists will say that maybe this was sabotaging Becky Lynch because WWE is in the Charlotte business. You know, she is their, aside from Ronda Rousey, their biggest women's star, and they push her like that. Maybe Becky was getting too popular for their liking when Charlotte's a babyface, and they decided to turn her heel to ensure that Charlotte was the top babyface and was getting all the babyface reaction. If that's the case, it blew up in their face. But we're seeing WWE creative more and more divorced from the reality of what their fan base wants or how their fan base thinks, or they just don't care. And they're just so arrogant that they don't care. And that could be it too.
What I think is really, really telling, it's just a small thing, but something that really shows the connection Becky has with the crowd was at SummerSlam. You know, everyone who comes out, they do their thing. They play to the crowd. Becky, she comes out, crowd cheers for her. There's an entire section, the hard camera section, has all these signs that say Becky's quinoa in it, you know, like Bailey's huggers or all the different Cesaro section inspired signs. And it's just a big wall of these signs. And I don't think the camera caught it because she was facing the crowd, not the cameras. But she pointed at the person who had like the biggest quinoa sign. And she pointed at her and she just made a little gesture like, are you ready? We're going to do this together tonight. You know, it's the solidarity fist. And she points to the ground like tonight's the night. That's such a small thing. But you don't see anyone else on the roster do that. And you have someone who does that. It's just such a small thing. But I see that. And I'm like, wow. She saw that one person. And she just made their night. And she's including them on this. So if I cheer for Becky, then I'm going to be in on this too. We're gonna win the title together. It's those little details that really make you want to cheer for Becky, and which makes me disappointed with the direction they've taken with it.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but you were not there for SmackDown Live. Is that correct?
I was not. I have to work on a few days eventually.
Okay. Okay. We had a couple of questions from our friend Frank Pettiani, now PWTorch.com contributor himself, about the live crowd, and that he was there as well. And I think he wanted to get your take on a couple of things, but I without you there live, I guess the questions are not as.
I can always lie.
I would hate to put you in that position, I guess is what I'll say. On SmackDown, we had New Day winning the tag titles from the Bludgeon Brothers, Samoa Joe attacking AJ Styles after a promo, and Brie Bella joining Daniel Bryan to face Maryse and The Miz. That match is now official for Hell in a Cell. One of two matches will also get a rematch between AJ Styles and Samoa Joe for the WWE title at Hell in a Cell. Is adding Brie and Maryse the right next step, do you think, for the Bryan-Miz feud?
Yeah, sure, why not? I mean, it's obviously a long-term storyline, so I don't see any negative to really come from it. They're both capable performers. Brie's arguably better in the ring than Maryse. Maryse is arguably better on the mic. But, you know, both of their husbands are incredible performers, so I'm sure I'll be fine.
Moving on to a couple of the other shows, non-WWE shows, 90 minutes into this show, we finally get to it. Triple Mania was last night, Triple A's big show of the year. Phoenix won the Triple A world title in a four-way over Brian Cage, Jeff Jarrett, and Rich Swann. Also, Hijo del Fantasmo was unmasked last night after a four-way cage match. Spoiler alert on the NXT UK title scene. Rhea Ripley has won the NXT UK women's title at the UK TV tapings that happened just today. All In is on Saturday night. Ben, will you be traveling to Chicago for All In?
I have quite a schedule coming up, actually, for all of my people who follow me on Twitter, at BTechertorch. This Saturday, I will be attending All In live in person. Feel free to drop by and say hi. I will also be 2 weeks after that. I will be in Los Angeles for all three nights of the 2018 Battle of Los Angeles. And the following 2 weeks after that, I'm going to be at the, I believe, Fighting Spirit Unleashed New Japan show in Long Beach. And then was it 2 or 3 weeks after that, I will be at Evolution back in New York. So no rest for the wicked.
Ben, a follow on Twitter. That's a real fan right there. I gotta applaud the dedication. And, you know, we're in a time in wrestling where you're not just going to shows, you're going to major shows that have major repercussions on the business, you know, All In, Evolution, the New Japan Long Beach shows. Those are major shows for the future of the business. So that's really cool that you're going to be able to be at all of those. We will talk extensively about All In next Sunday night here on Wrestling Night in America, 8 p.m. Eastern, pwtorchlivecast.com. The lineup for that show, Nick Aldis versus Cody for the NWA title, Okada versus Marty Scurll, Joey Janela takes on Hangman Adam Page, Rey Mysterio, Phoenix, and Bandito versus the Golden Elite. That's one of Rey Mysterio's final independent dates before he presumably starts up again with WWE. Daniels versus Stephen Amell. The Briscoes brothers take on SoCal Uncensored. There's a 15-person over-budget battle royal, and the winner of that will face Jay Lethal for the ROH TV title later in the show. Madison Rayne versus Britt Baker versus Chelsea Green versus Tessa Blanchard in a women's four-way. And the main event, Kenny Omega versus Pentagon Jr. Also, coming up this week, Impact has one of their major television shows called Redefined. This past week on Impact, Matt Sydal defeated Zachary Wentz. Falaba and KM won over the Desi Hit Squad. Kira Hogan defeated Alicia Edwards. Brandon Tidwell and Mr. Atlantis got the upset win over the Cult of Lee. And in the main event, Sami Callihan won a Mexican death match over Pentagon. At Redefined this Thursday night, it's going to be Petey Williams against Rich Swann. There's going to be a special segment, The Smoke Show, with Scarlett Bordeaux. She will have Grado, Katarina, and Joe Hendry as her guests. Brian Cage takes on Phoenix for the X Division title. Moose and Eddie Edwards team up to take on Austin Aries and his associate, Killer Cross. And Allie versus Sue Young versus Tessa Blanchard in a three-way for the Knockouts title. That's all the news that's fit to print this week on Wrestling Night in America. Ben, thank you for joining me tonight and offering your firsthand perspective of some of the major shows this past weekend, SummerSlam weekend.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure. And remember, everyone, if you're sick and tired of WWE, there is New Japan, which is amazing. And if you don't like New Japan, then there's your local indie fed. And if you don't want to watch that, there's the UK scene. There's the Australian scene. There's other places in Japan. Now is such an incredible time to be a wrestling fan, and you can watch so much for so little. You can, I mean, just on YouTube right now, you can watch MLW every Saturday for free, which if you're a fan of WCW, Tony Schiavone's on the call, and it's such a breath of fresh air. There's CMLL uploads their big, Raw equivalent, Friday show. They live stream it on YouTube. AAA, if you want to watch their big Triple Mania show, why don't you want to? It's like the Mexican WrestleMania. Do it. It's free. on Twitch. You can still watch it. It's all saved up there, ready to go. It is probably the best time since life began if you're a fan of pro wrestling. So, yeah,
not only all that, but all the archived footage on the WWE Network and on YouTube of all kinds of different wrestling organizations of the past. So, the access, the ease of access has never been easier to watch as many pro wrestling shows as you want, and the variety is amazing. So there's, if you're a wrestling fan, there's bound to be something out there for you, even if WWE isn't your bag. So I think Ben Tucker again, thank you for listening here on PWTorchLivecast.com. You can find me on Twitter at Greg M. Parks. And until next weekend, here is the way for you to go VIP and get a PW Torch membership and all the benefits right here.
PW Torch Livecast listeners, this show can be ad-free and commercial-free with a VIP membership. VIP members not only enjoy all 7 episodes of the PW Torch Livecast with no commercials and the ads and plugs edited out, but they also get ad-free editions of the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling post shows and the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling podcast. Also, part of a VIP membership and exclusive shows such as the Every Single Day Wade Keller Hotline, the 3 times a week Bruce Mitchell audio show, including a new weekly mailbag edition with Bruce, The Fix with Todd Martin that I also host, post-pay-per-view roundtables that I host, and other shows on specific topics, including the new Talking Honor podcast with Lola and Harley discussing the latest in ROH, including the review of the latest TV show. And now we are proud to announce that Alan Cunahan, known as Alan 4L, has brought his talents to PW Torch after many years at The Observer. And there's a lot of excitement about his new weekly show called Alan 4L's Pro Wrest Paradise, with the best coverage of New Japan, all of Japan, the UK indie scene, including the US indie scene. So be sure to become a PW Torch VIP member for as little as $8.25 a month on average, and have multiple new VIP exclusive and ad-free podcasts every day on customizable feeds on your iPhone and Android device. For more information and our sign-up form, go to pwtorch.com/govip. And you'll find out what else comes with VIP membership, including a weekly newsletter, over 1,500 back issues of the Pro Wrestling Torch weekly newsletter that started it all, ad-free access to our mobile and desktop sites, and more. Full lineup, full details, and the sign-up form at pwtorch.com/govip. No!